This is the Partnership Playbook, a podcast helping sales and marketing leaders secure high-value partnerships that finally unlock business growth and reclaim time. I'm your coach, Phil Hayes Sinclair. Welcome to the show.
Right, everyone, welcome to the Partnership Playbook podcast, where we explore how leaders can build strategic partnerships, close high-value deals, and scale growth with clarity and trust. I'm your host, Phil Hayes Sinclair, and today's guest is Matt Jira, a leader who deeply understands what it takes to build ventures from the ground up without relying on outside capital. And this is going to be very important for our conversation today. And he also is fantastic at cultivating ecosystems of support to let founders thrive. Matt leads student entrepreneurship efforts at Yale, and he also writes a fantastic newsletter called The Quarter. So we are going to dive into a report that Matt writes. We're going to dive into what he has learned over time, particularly for entrepreneurs listening to this who are trying to bootstrap their business from zero to 250K in revenue, that first step, which is all important. And so, Matt, it is a real pleasure to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Let's dive right in, because I know a fair bit about your work. People listening might be meeting you for the first time. What mission are you on?
I'm on this mission to help people that maybe never were thought of themselves as founders really build wealth through entrepreneurship. I think entrepreneurship is one of the most impactful things ever. I think there's like this like storyline or this like stereotype that like you have to be born with entrepreneurship, and that's just not true. And I think just helping people become entrepreneurs and really have ownership in the businesses they're doing and building more bootstrap businesses, that to me is like one of my big missions for sure.
I love that. Now, being somebody who has built 8 companies before, I started my journey in 2004, 2003, I think, where the tools and the way that we think about building a business now they seem primitive now compared to what we have at our fingertips right now. So this is really singing to me, and I'm very keen to learn about how you have cultivated an ecosystem, because at a place like Yale, you know, it is a hotbed of ideas, no doubt. And there will be people who will be coming to this thinking, is there another path, not knowing that there might be? And I'm curious to understand, what is it like, do you think, when people realize for the first time that they don't have to follow a linear path in a career, where they can sort of go, actually, you know what, I could build something, like maybe there is a way that I could do this. How does that work in your current ecosystem?
Yeah, so in the Yale ecosystem, it's so unique. I did not go to Yale. I went to a small little school called Hope College in West Michigan. It's like this 3,200 people student, like barely people. No one knows what that school is. Or Yale, right? Everyone knows what Yale is. And you come to like the talent at Yale, right, is so top notch, right? And they're coming from like places like McKinsey and like Meta and like, you know, pick a brand, like, right? That's a lot of them are coming, especially the grad students, the professional school students, like they're coming from those big brands a lot of the time. Not all the time, but a lot of them. And then Yale College students, like, they're just like uber, uber talented, right? Like that's what Yale's known for, is their undergrad. And those students, right, are just like wicked smart, and they can go find a role. I mean, pick a place, right? They have their kind of opportunity. People are on campus all the time recruiting them. So I think the challenge I think we have at Yale is sometimes from an entrepreneurial standpoint is telling them like, hey, you don't have to like chase the big fancy logos and build the resume builders because you're already at Yale. So it's this whole like, and they come to Yale, right? And the other dynamic that we face is like, especially if they were maybe part of a smaller, maybe a smaller community that's like, they were the big fish, right? And they were the big talent. They come to Yale and like the playing field is leveled, right? Yeah. Everyone's super talented. Everyone's got like, you know, this wicked backstory a lot of times, wicked being a really good thing. And so I think they get this like, oh my gosh, everyone's amazing and I'm no good anymore. Mm. And I think we have to sometimes just build that confidence back up and say like, hey, no, like you still can do these things. So there's a lot of like the mental games with Yale, which I think people don't really understand like a lot of those dynamics until like, you're on campus at least for like a year or so.
It's funny. A very good friend of mine who I think is probably gonna be listening to this, David Burt, who runs entrepreneurship for the University of New South Wales, one of our largest colleges here. I think he would say exactly what you've just said, you know, where there is this innate fascination, if you've been in technology, that entrepreneurship could be a thing. his huge passion, which I laud him for, is bringing in the deep scientists, the art students, and the like, to sort of go, actually, there is a different way for you to think about the career that you thought you were here to pursue. And I think that's just so much fun. And when you stand up in front of those audiences and you just see the light bulb go off that there is a different path where, you know, their parents have come from very traditional industries where, like you say, they come from really fantastic, like they've done everything to get to school, right? Like it is all in service of doing that. And then there's almost this light bulb moment. I think there's almost more care needed to help them tell their parents that they might be thinking about something different compared to doing, you know, compared to them doing the thing. So it's very interesting stuff.
Totally. I mean, I even had like the parents conversation, like when I started my journey, because I ran a tech company for a little bit, and telling them like, hey, I'm actually going to like not go to grad school to like start this like company. Like that holiday season was like so messy when I was making that decision, because they're like, what are you doing? Why are we throwing this all away and all this stuff? So like, you know, I felt it, and I see students right all the time, especially if right like you're like first generation, like all these right, all the family dynamics are so alive and all this, and that's such a big part of this too. And then I think one of the things that's like at Yale, right, is Yale's not just like a tech hub; it's like it's the number one arts drama school in the world.
That's
like
it
is point blank entertainment; like it is elite. And I think that's a unique part of the Yale ecosystem that I think Yale's finally like leaning into and saying like, no, actually, why don't we build the next Netflix series? Why don't we build the next big YouTube creators? Like, I think Yale's starting to understand that, which is, I think, super exciting across the innovation ecosystem. I think it's really good for like innovation in general to like bring the arts into the picture too.
I think it's super important. I mean, the way to think, particularly if you're in a discipline like design, or you're a not, in inverted commas, a non-technical, which I think is what we should just define for everybody. When people say, you know, you're a technical founder, generally that means you can code software. We are thinking about this in the broadest possible terms. You know, we have incredible entrepreneurs that have built deep technology in things like the way that servers work, right through to the way that scientists discover new vaccines, new tools, new ways to look at, you know, so many parts of a scientific ecosystem. We have such opportunity in this. And when we think about the arts coming into this, I just for one want to say that most of my companies would not have survived if it wasn't for people that come from arts discipline, in particular design, who are able to fundamentally break apart all the bias that we had inside what we were trying to build. So, yeah, I am totally with the inclusion of those disciplines to what we're doing.
Yeah, I think just the way the approach, right, and seeing those like right, the arts and the tech like collide at Yale is like one of the cool, like one of the majors they have at Yale College is like computer and the art, or computer science and the arts.
Yep,
and it's like I think one of the coolest majors like of all time, because like you're learning how to code, but also like learning like, okay, what does it mean to be creative too? And I think like having that blend and even just like this foundational, like that's almost like a superpower, just to be able to like balance both of them. I think that to me that's like the best founder. One of the best majors, I think, for founders at Yale, because I just, you have such a unique perspective on things.
Yeah, I think it's awesome. Matt, when you think about measuring success in these ecosystems, you know, there will be, my experience at least has been that there is a very large business in education, which is generally the students coming through, they could be coming from overseas, they could be coming domestically, but there is a large, like enormous business of teaching people stuff. And when entrepreneurship comes into the game, it tends to be, at least it usually begins at a very small, interesting, but small function or capability inside a university. When you think about innovation and you think about how that should be measured, how at Yale does that get sort of assessed and measured to help you do your job and for the people in your teams to do that kind of work? Because, you know, somewhat paradoxically, when you look outside of all of that backwards, the greatest discoveries and the greatest work that has driven huge economic impact, you know, 20, 30 years down the track, came from people doing really big stuff at college that only gets recognized retrospectively. So how is sort of success for you and your ecosystem thought about?
That's a really great question, because I think that's the question I think a lot of people at Yale are asking, like, currently, like, how do we actually do this? I think you see this, like, kind of across the innovation, I think, ecosystems across the university systems right now, is like, how do we actually do that? Because, right, as you mentioned, right, like, innovation is like a 30-year journey a lot of the times. Mm-hmm. And like, from a, like, a ROI standpoint, like, how do you measure that? Like, and how, like, how do you actually know that, like, what you're doing today is actually kind of pay off? Like, it's so tough. So like, for me, like, I always see it, right? Cause we're also working typically, right? Like, the Yale student is probably anywhere from like 18 to like 30 years old mm-hmm. most of the time. So to me, like, a lot of times, like, the founders aren't like, them having a successful venture is like pretty minuscule at that time, at that time frame.
That's right.
But right, the skill set and those foundational stuff, like, if they can understand, like, here's how I build things, here's how, like, the like, founder entrepreneurial skill set, if we can give them that, like, the payoff is going to be there, because they might, this venture that they're working on now, or even maybe the one they're joining, like, chances of that working are pretty slim. But the one that's like 2-3, like, a decade from now, like, the chances of that are so much higher. And I think that's the part that, like, we should be investing in. Like, I've always seen it as, like, whatever we're doing is a 30-year investment. I've done that since my very first time, even outside of Yale. Like, whatever, whoever I'm investing in, like, you know, just as a person, like, there's a good chance, like, in 30 years from now, they're going to have a really great venture. And, like, am I going to have, like, my personal payout from that? No. But, like, if they can build a really successful venture, you know, change their family's lives, and then also just, like, change maybe the community around them, like, that's the best way. Like, that's why to do this work, right? So if they can change kind of how the world works and have that positive impact. So that, to me, is like what we should be measuring. And how do we actually, you know, how are we measuring those skill sets? How are they changing, you know, how they're operating? That's, to me, is like what we should be measuring now. And then, you know, the payoff, I think we just kind of keep track of, and you can kind of just, it's more of a qualitative versus, I think, quantitative data from an innovation standpoint a lot of the time.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting? Because I was talking about this with my wife just yesterday. Having been an entrepreneur for so long, the tools that you amass over time allow you to dramatically go to market in a way which is so much quicker. I mean, we all know that skills compound, but, you know, even defining an offer, you know, bringing capital to the table, assembling a team, knowing what to look for, knowing what not to do, all the things that can only come with practice. You're right. It sort of comes at that, you know, 3, 4, 5 venture point. And if you're fortunate enough, I guess, to follow those people and invest in them business after business and have the patience to know that it's not going to work out every time, I think there is capacity for massive financial payoff. But it does take you to track and understand and to have that encouragement through that's sort of those steps of learning, which can take a long time. But the payoff, I think, is definitely there. And I'm really hoping that many more people, even if they don't do it full time, they're going into that at some point early in their career so they can understand what this is all about.
Yeah. And I even tell students, right, like, even if they're like, I think, you know, every spring there's always a handful of students that are like so disappointed because they're like, I can't go full time, right? They can't pay the bills. Like, and they're like so disappointed that they can't do that. But I'm like, okay, yes, you might be quitting your venture now or like putting on pause or like maybe going part time with it. But like, the payoff is going to show up because like your next venture is going to be like a million times better because you're going to, you know, you're all those little silly mistakes you've been making, like those are all going to, those are going away.
100%.
Right. And so you can have these huge, and then like whatever organization you join, right, you're going to be like a power player because you'd be like, oh, what about this? What about that? And so that to me is like, they can just see things in such a different light, and that's so impactful in so many different ways.
Let's turn to the work that I learned you first around, which is this idea of documenting how entrepreneurs go from no cash revenue being made to their first $250,000, which is a really, and for those who are not familiar with entrepreneurship, there are certain milestones that are very important in a company's life to get off the ground. And it's really that, you know, how do we get the plane from moving from nothing to actually taking off and actually having some momentum behind it? You elected to sort of measure and talk about from a standing start to $250,000 in annual recurring revenue. And it resulted in a fantastic report being written, which helps people understand, you know, why this is so important, who's doing it, how do they do it, what does it mean? Can we dive into that for a minute? Because it's a very unique product that you've made, which helps, I think, as we would often say, you can't be what you can't see. So when you can sort of see it, it makes it, I think, a lot more achievable. And when you break it down to what, you know, $250,000 in cash is a year, that might sound a lot to people, but for a company that can mean the difference between really taking off and just not quite getting off the ground. So can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah. So about a year ago now, I was like super fascinated about these bootstrap companies have gone from zero to 250, because 250, as you've seen, right? Like 250 seems to be like this magical point from what I've talked to, because like you're starting to build a team, like you're paying your bills, like things are just a little bit different once you hit 250. And I was like super fascinated to be like, okay, how are you actually doing that? Because those that are doing venture backed, like I can tell that story. I think that's more public. The bootstrap ones are like, they're kind of some, a lot of times just like hiding in plain sight. You just like, they might be around your corner, but you don't know they actually exist. And I was like, how are they actually building it without like these ad budgets, these venture backable things, all that kind of stuff. And so I studied over 60 of them, 64 founders. It's 56 businesses that are bootstrapped, and they went from zero to 250. A lot of them I had one-on-one conversations with, and just talking about their growth strategies, their time to 250, where they're even located. Like I tried to study everything I possibly could and put it all into one report, which is the Bootstrap Report. Launched it out in January, and it's this report of like, okay, here's how you actually do it. Like not just like someone's personal like story, like no, like here's 64 founders telling you how they did it. Mm-hmm. And there's been so many fascinating things, like building a community, right? Like gets you to 250 almost a year faster.
Yeah.
Like it's all these little tidbits that like, yes, that might be obvious like in hindsight, but it wasn't obvious at the time. And like 2.5 years being like the average time to 250K in annual revenue, that to me was like, oh my gosh, like yes, that makes sense, because it takes the first year to kind of figure things out. And then you take another year and a half to figure things out. So like, it makes more sense now, like looking at it, but I think it's been a super interesting data point for me. And the data keeps getting even more interesting as I'm starting to build it out and do more and more interviews.
I love this so much, because you're right. In the middle of building something, you never know, right? You hope you're making directionally good bets, but the idea about community is a big one. And I've got a bunch of stories around that. But when you think about bootstrap versus venture backed, and for those again who are listening who might not be from the early stage investment space, you will often hear and see press releases from companies who have just announced raising a ton of money from a whole bunch of, you know, reasonably well-known venture capitalists. And I have a personal unpopular view about those press releases. I think they're lightning rods for startups. I often think it's very, very tricky, because it puts a line in the sand about, you know, they've now got the clock's on, right? For 18 months time, if we don't see another announcement, there's a good chance things haven't gone so well. But, you know, when you think about the trade-offs that you've seen between those founders you've reported on, the 64 versus all of the other ones I'm sure you've seen who've raised money from investors, what do you think the trade-offs are that they're making in that moment? Because it's very attractive. You know, when you get to, you know, a place like Yale, I'm sure you have big pitching nights, you've got big investor days, you've got people coming in to look for the best new talent. They're looking to you going, hey, so Matt, you know, point us to where we should go. We've got, you know, full checkbooks to deploy capital to see these new ventures work. What are the trade-offs that these entrepreneurs are computing at the time when there's sort of like this appeal for big money, or at least quicker money than it would be to then go and bootstrap, versus maybe the delayed gratification of not having that money, but having to really make the money to have the money?
Yeah, I think the scary part is, like, the struggle I have, I think, is a lot of students at Yale and these like big schools that we're like all the VCs are hanging out with, they don't understand what VC actually is. Mm-hmm. And they don't understand like what the dynamics are. They're just like, they see it as like the validation, because that's what they chased to how to get, that's how they got to Yale. Yeah. Chase the big logos and do, here's the right steps. And they see like a Y Combinator, they see like the A16Z, right? The big logos, like they're like, that's my next validation point. Like they see it just as like a linear process. Mm. And it's like, that's not what that is. Those are not awards. Those are just like maybe really cool partners.
Yeah.
And they have to be for the right business. So you see like where my struggle was a lot is like, you see like really good businesses, like they start turning out really good amounts of revenue, like 50K, 60K. And then they'll be like, oh, I need to go raise money because that's what I've been told I need to do. Mm-hmm. Well, like, just because you've been told you need to do it doesn't mean it's the right actually action.
Yeah.
So I think that's a lot of times, like I'm like doing some educating and like telling students like, you don't, and like there's this weird false narrative about you're not a real founder if you haven't raised money. And I'm like, that's just a lie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's the, like, there's just all these lies and assumptions that like are just so baked into all this stuff. Yeah. Just because, like, all the hype train and things like that. So I think I'm spending a lot of time on that piece of it. Like the education piece, like there's a place for VCs and like there's a place for venture backable companies in building that. But there's so many good businesses that would be so much better off, and the founders including, like if they never raise money, because right, if you don't raise money, right, you can pay your team in different ways, like, and you can like keep, you can build a vision that you want to go. You can do things you've never been able to do as a venture backed company, and you also control how you want to build. Like
that's
you,
it.
Just because a VC doesn't see the return, you know, in X amount of time, if they can't, right, they're gonna start changing things up and like maybe closing up shop just because like they can't get their math right. Mm-hmm. Whereas for you, like the math might be right for you. And if you don't raise money, right, you can just keep it going. But like, so it just, the power dynamics, all the stuff you, and like, I think for me, when I was raising money in my first company, it was, you know, you just turn into fundraising mode. You're not actually building anything. All you're doing is talking to VCs all the time.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that was never why I got into this. So there's like this first time founder stuff, like they just don't realize it. And like, I was in that boat too.
Yeah. It's interesting, right? Because you cannot do many other things when you're in fundraising mode. Right. And, oh man, we could dive so deep on this. Like there is the raising money so you can have a runway to do the things you think you want to do. But it is almost as if you are sitting in front of two taps or two faucets. You turn one on and that is the energy to go and raise the money. The other one is very hard turned off because you can't really do much more than obsess over this process. And the irony is once you do it for the first time and you're successful in doing that, you will be going back to do the same thing again. And you're really hoping, actually banking on the idea that you've got a team to keep on building and keeping the momentum going while you're out there fundraising again. I remember stepping out of my businesses for months at a time to go and do this and not being able to have a full attention to the product roadmap, to the bugs that we were seeing, to the community that was being neglected, all the things that you just go, oh, I just need more time. And it just never really came. One of my favorite stories about bootstrapped businesses, I think right now, and anyone who has any clue about email marketing and the work that Kit had done, you know, Nathan Barry had done as the founder to make this very scrappy email marketing service, I think 2013 is when they started, to get to a point now, which I think is almost a $50 million business. Fantastic. And I have only a relationship as a customer to them, but just a fantastic story of perseverance and just holding on long enough to generate cash to make it one of the best products in this in their field. Like there are stories about this everywhere. It just doesn't seem to get the hype that the venture back stuff does.
Yeah. And I think I saw that kind of live because we brought Nathan actually in to Yale. Mm-hmm. To be like one of our keynote speakers 2 years ago, and people didn't even know what Kit was. I was like, you know, like they make $45 million a year in revenue. And like, if you do the multiplier, right, that's a $450 million company probably. Yeah. And so it's like, this is a monster business. Mm-hmm. You just like, because they're not venture backed, you don't know they exist. And like, there's the hype train wasn't there. Like I was like, Nathan's amazing. Like, so people who knew about Kit and Nathan, like I'm also just one of the biggest fanboys for Kit. Mm-hmm. Like, knew that because of that, but like it just was like this, like it wasn't a dud, like we still got a lot of good people and things like that, but it wasn't like if we brought in someone else who was venture backed, it would have been a completely different atmosphere.
Isn't that amazing?
And I was like, yeah,
we've got this wrong.
Like, that shouldn't be the difference. Why? Yeah, like this is like the wrong story and the wrong thing to be chasing. So
and look, you know, I have a lot of time for Nathan, and when I listen to what his lifestyle is like now versus what I think the life of entrepreneurs is, who are having to work within the natural constraint of having investors, and which at least in the Australian case, when you get to 50 investors in a private company, that company has to sort of flip over into what's called an unlisted public company. So it's not listed on a stock exchange, but there's a whole new set of rules. There's a whole new set of things that come with that transition. And in countries where the VC ecosystem is not very mature, Australia is certainly one of those. So it's mature in a small sense, it just hasn't got the scale. It means that you end up having to bring on so many smaller investors to drive the capital requirements of a business that you end up having, if you do this well, like I think I've done before, a fantastic investor roster, but that's 60 plus people you have to communicate with and support and be involved with. Whereas there, all of this goes away if you can find a way to make the difficult first step work in those early days to become a cash flow driven business. And for anyone thinking about what this is, and of course there are government grants, there's a whole bunch of other things you can pursue to have the capital you need to make things work. But this topic is one which is not talked about anywhere near enough.
No, I think actually for student entrepreneurs, it should be like hammered. Because actually, I think for student entrepreneurs in particular, I think they have the best opportunities for just like to build a bootstrap company. Because like the amount of pitch competitions that they have are just free grant money. Like they're the only ones with that opportunity. I wish we could do it outside of the student ecosystem, but like I don't know how you actually do that without. Yeah, I think you need a bigger organization to really focus on that. But like, I think like if you could build right just like a bunch of grants, even if they're $25,000 checks, like not monstrous in these big things, but like helping people get off the ground.
Yep.
That to me is like absolute game changer. And if you can like, I know multiple companies that have come through Yale and even outside of Yale that have, you know, raised essentially 200K in grants plus.
Yeah.
And they just are fully bootstrapped forever and ever because like that was their initial capital and like they never need to raise money. And they kind of follow a venture backed route, but like they're still bootstrapped. They're still thinking big and all these things. So like there's like this weird also the concept, right? If you're not raising money, you're not thinking big enough. And it's like, that's not true either.
No, that's not true either. No, I can very much attest to that. Matt, what, you know, we're in 2024, we're recording this in 2025. I think most people would agree the world is in a pretty interesting spot right now. There doesn't seem to be a lot of good news coming out of anywhere at the minute. And, you know, there is probably, people's minds are probably going to a place of more conservatism in terms of the work they do, the opportunities they pursue. When you are talking to entrepreneurs, founders who are thinking about what they should be doing over the next couple of years, whether they're just starting or whether there's a, yeah, they're well and truly on their way, what trends and shifts are you sort of encouraging them to think about from this point forward, maybe over the next, you know, 24, 36 months?
Yes, I think there's two of them I think that stand out to me. One would be part of community. I think that's the part that like there's all this like hype train about like, oh, just like go like be quiet for 60 days or whatever, go dark and like just build for those 60 days and like don't tell anyone about it. Like, that is such a bad story to tell. And like, it's so isolating because then you end up doing it again because it didn't work and you just do it again. And then all of a sudden you've been isolated for 18 months and like, you didn't do anything. You're super depressed and everything. Like that's not the way to do it.
Doesn't sound great.
So like, it never sounds great, but that there's so much posts about that. And I'm like, stop. And so like be part of a community. Like I think it's whether it's online communities, like, right. Like Chanel's and Growth in Reverse. There's like the Lab with Jay Klaus. There's so many, I think, new communities that are popping up even virtually, but now even I think you're seeing them even in person pop up, like the co-working spaces, right? Like I think there's more and more of like, there's like this rebound of co-working, which I think is great. And I think, right, if you can be part of those, even if it's like, hey, I'm popping to the entrepreneurial community in your local ecosystem, be part of that. Cause I think there's so much value just being like, be able to go to someone next to you and be like, okay, I have that problem too. And they're just being, especially with all, like, as you mentioned, there's so much going on. Being able to just like have these like off the record, here's what's going on conversations, like those are so powerful even in the earliest days.
Yeah.
And I think number two, which I think for the early, this is like you're getting started. I think one of the things you're not seeing, I think in the US, right, like the deck is stacked against people trying to start. I think it's actually, then once you get past the start and you're actually full time, I think actually then the deck is stacked towards you. So it's this weird dynamic in my mind. But I think one of the things is like, right, if you have a full time job and you're seeing, I think, a lot of full time employees build side hustles and those employers actually being okay with it. And you're seeing more and more of that, which I think is great because it gives people more of like this like diversified revenue portfolio essentially of their income. And I think, right, just based on the data that I've seen through Adam Grant and other things, like having that stability of financial and to be able to take some shots, whether they're bootstrap, like that are boot, like when you're bootstrapping a business, that to me is like you're building a better business because you're not trying to chase the dollar or not trying to chase be like, oh, I need healthcare right this month or things like that. Right. Yep. So like, I think people are building better businesses because like they're like, right, that like, you know, the pyramid of needs, right? Like you have like what you need, the foundation's there. And because of that, you can go take some better shots and build the right thing versus the thing that just makes money.
Isn't it interesting? We I've often been faced when suggesting inside my businesses that I encourage people to do side hustles because I run a portfolio career, and you know, I'm building something. There is always generally other businesses that have been pre-existing that I've spent a little bit of time on, and balancing that ability to focus on the main game, but then allow your brain to sort of wander a little bit into something a little bit more creative, I've found to be of such massive relief over 30 years for a whole range of reasons. I think for the most part, people find that difficult to compute in their own minds. You know, I'm already working, already exerting a lot of effort into my primary thing. I'm worried that I might be perceived to be not taking it seriously if, you know, if I'm not all in on the one thing. And I'm not sure that that's a healthy way to have teams operate, because I think if we're completely honest with ourselves, we are getting a proportion of their attention and their time as team members. As Reid Hoffman said in his fantastic book, where he talked about the alliance, the best that we can hope for when we hire people, particularly when you're an entrepreneur in your, when you're not able to pay market rates for, you know, what people would ordinarily make somewhere else, and you can't offer them a huge amount of benefit, but you can offer them future upside. This idea that they would come to you, they are an ally of yours at the very best. They are not a member of a family. Don't get me started on that narrative. And it's certainly not the case they're giving you everything when they come to work. They are your ally at best. And so when we think about how we can set people up for success, one of the, when people get to me in the recruiting stage, it's often the last conversation. And my first question to them is, what is your next play after you finish here? And let's imagine you're here for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And I usually don't get great answers from that question, but I do follow up with them to get an answer if they're successful. But if they're not successful, I ask the question again as well. And that's the precursor to me understanding what opportunities I can afford them to get them to that place. And one of the core opportunities is do something on the side and I'll back you, right? And it is such an unexpected offer so early in someone's tenure. But I think as a CEO who's a co-founder, it's a really strong signal to send so that they can understand at a human level that you've got their back, and that, you know, it might be a point where, yes, I would love you to be committing 210% to what you're doing here, but we're human. And if you're creative in the smallest degree, you know, I want you to build that muscle, right? Because it can only benefit all of us at the end of the day.
Yeah. And I think to that point too, I've been really lucky because like I have a full-time job, but like everywhere I've gone has been super supportive of me having a side hustle, and they've been like investing in it to like check in on it. Like that to me has been huge. Cause like, and also I think it actually provides a lot of value back, because like everything that I'm learning in the side hustle comes back,
of course,
to what I'm doing in my full time. Yeah. And like, it's all stuff that like, I'm not even like, you really can't measure it. There's no like, oh, like here's what I learned here and like it applied here. Like, a lot of times it's just more like all these little things I'm picking up, and then all of a sudden, right, it's like blossomed into it. So I think like a lot of my like professional development has been like me just doing this side hustle, experimenting, and then bringing that back. And like when you're, you know, what I've been doing at Yale is like a little bit of a bigger stage of what I'm doing creatively currently. But right, I think all of that like plays really nicely. And I think, right, if you can build, you know, and be in a different area of the, you know, of the world and just the, you know, different industries, categories, that you're not normally in your full-time job, I think there's just so much value in that. Cause you also can see someone else's work in a totally different light.
I would encourage leaders who are listening to this to ask their teams if they are involved in a side hustle, and very quickly in asking that question, knowing that if you're around the room of your team, they're probably not going to say a great deal, really tease it out of them in an encouraging way. Because what I've found in my experience, at least, you know, being able to say, that is super interesting, tell me about what you're learning on that, is it enriches the relationship to a point where great things happen. And of course, you're expecting them to do what they're being paid to do. And good people will recognize that and just go, listen, I just want you to know, I just work on this on Saturdays. And just go, super cool. I'll be honest, as long as you're doing fantastic work here and we're hitting the milestones we've all agreed are really important, then I really don't mind when you do it. But I'm just really pumped that you're creatively pursuing a skill set that I think ultimately will benefit all of us. So yeah, please keep doing it. And of course, I've only had to have a couple of conversations where that side hustle has overtaken the real work. But, you know, I think on balance, it's a really important thing to be doing.
Yeah, I've been like super lucky. I mean, all of my people I've reported to in the past 5 years of, and like even like my next one, like they've been super supportive and like just like, hey, what's going on? How can I support you? And like being thought partners and like, actually, like, do you really want to be doing that? And so just like double checking me, because they're also seeing me the day to day, which I think is super helpful. So you can, and they see things in a different light too. So I think it's kind of have like a coach and a business coach in some ways, just like, in, at least for me, it's been that way in some ways, just like an advisor in a way that I never thought I would have.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Matt, let's talk about partnerships. You know, we operate in circles where the ability for a business to grow and to be sustainable often hinges on whether an organization is good at creating relationships where their products can be sold, where the supply chains can be, you know, secured, or where they can co-develop new things together. I would like to understand, you know, your perspective from the Yale point of view, and also in the other work that you do around the role of partnerships and how they're playing a role in growth right now. It's obviously a point of curiosity for the show, but I think you have a very unique vantage point from where you're seeing growth happen. So what are you seeing in the way that partnerships are being used to grow these small businesses?
Yeah. So I think from the center I'm in at Yale, so we are the Sci Center for Innovative Thinking at Yale, and the way they've built it is to be innovative thinking in just all, like, in the broadest term. And like, right, every marketer knows, right, like everyone is no one, but like that's literally the mission they've given us, is like, give, like, we want you to work with pretty much all the students at Yale. Mm-hmm. So with that, right, it becomes this, like, we really can't go deep in anything, but we can be super shallow in kind of everything. And from our standpoint, like the last 5 years or so, we've been really struggling of like, okay, how do you actually accomplish that mission, but also allow students to go deep? Because they need to, they're Yale students. They need to build a venture that goes deep and things like that. And one of the ways we've done this, like, credit, big credit to my team, like Shade, Grace, Isabel, like they absolutely like not like, this is the model I think that like Yale should like fully invest in. I'm super biased, but like, this model's worked the last 3 years. And basically what we've done is we've made it right. As you can imagine, Yale is like exclusive. People like exclusivity at Yale. We also want to be super inclusive. And the way we've kind of put it is like, how do we hack exclusivity? Mm-hmm. And the way we've done it is we run like a very general accelerator program. So it's very like shallow, like here's how you build a venture. How do you like, you know, mission and vision? How do you build a financial model? How do you, if you want to raise money, right? Like super shallow, hits all the different topics. But then what we've been able to do is actually go to the other centers on campus. And I think there's a world where like you can even go outside of campus and be like, hey, do you want your own accelerator? Because like you just partner with us. Students can check box. Like, for example, we work with the Sustainable Health Initiative, which is like global health and world health. And we work with them. They're like, oh yeah, we love an accelerator program. So if there are any ventures that are working within global health, we then send them to that center that's working on global health. So they're getting our support from a general standpoint.
Yeah.
But like all their health questions go straight to that center, and that center now has an accelerator, which is just ours, but we just like pair our events together. All the workshops play nicely together. We loop it all in. And now we've been able to kind of scale that up with like our engineering department, where we're going to probably bring in like, you know, you can bring in the arts, you can bring in kind of everyone on campus, and they get their own accelerator program, which is like the general, but then they can fit in workshops and mentors and things like that. And we have right, essentially this toolbox of kit of like, here's how you actually can do it.
Yes.
But based on the current resources that you have now, like we're really just like repackaging everything. And then like, you can just come on Fridays to all the sessions and we'll make sure you get to the right place. So that's the part, like we're making campus, right? Because Yale is such a big place, but it's also very siloed. And so I think what we've been able to do is really bridge the partnerships within campus. And really, we're starting to really make this like web of partnerships that I think, again, I think they can go outside of campus, where we can work with like other organizations that like need all that support and support even entrepreneurs across the globe.
I love that. I love that. And let's overlay for a minute, and this is a little bit off script, but let's overlay the framework that I tend to look at partnerships through to help sort of work out the robustness of steps like this, because, you know, there are essentially five questions to ask when it comes to really fantastic partnerships. and ones that persevere and generate value, as opposed to logos that everyone, you know, often tries to pursue, thinking that that's some form of traction. You know, when it comes to your team reaching out to a center like that, where they're super curious, super excited, the first galvanizing step here is the intent that can be exchanged between both organizations, right? The ability for somebody to say, in writing, we're on the same page, and this is, you know, on, if you imagine one PowerPoint slide on the left-hand side, this is what we're great at, this is what your team at Yale is great at, this is what we are great at, and in the middle, this is what we can achieve together. No more than three things, but this is what we can achieve together. On the next slide, it says, if we were to pursue a partnership, here are the three trusting steps we would achieve together to prove to each other that it's worth our time. And this step in its own right is the step that often brings partnerships to an end, because no one's taken the time, even though it's only two slides and it's large font, so it's not as though we're writing, you know, War and Peace here. It's just telling people that this is what the shared intent is. That is the first step. And I'm sure that from the curiosity standpoint, that is a very easy step for your teams to get over the line, right?
Yes and no. I think it depends on the center. Because I think, right, some centers are like, they're like, oh, we don't want, innovation's not what we do, right? Like if you're in like the math department, like how, what's innovative, sure, about math, right? Like, so if they're like, you know, that's
to all the math, all the math lovers out there, I'm sure you know it is. We just don't. So let's continue.
Right. So I think there's like, there's probably definitely departments on campus, and like it depends on the faculty member too, right? Because some, mm-hmm, faculty members are like, oh no, I just want to do research. That's fine. Right. And like, so like there's this, it just depends on the person you're talking to. But I think given the traction we've had, and like, and we now have like a portfolio of like, here's all these different companies that have come out. And so now we can kind of go to these centers and be like, hey, we built, there's this student that came out of your department built this. Do you want to credit for this? Mm-hmm. So like we're getting better at it. Nice. But yeah, it's not every, some centers are like, they're, you know, they're going for it, but yeah, it's been different every center we've talked to.
Yeah. I've no doubt about that. So that's the intent. Then we go to dual benefit. And this is the idea that there should be at least two benefits per side of a partnership. So there is a good amount of redundancy, because whenever there's just one benefit, it tends to favor one party over the other, because one party has come either sort of cap in hand, or the other one has exerted so much reputational influence that the other party doesn't feel like they can ask for much. And for the most part, those two measures don't have to be financial. Right. If you're talking about a new founder bootstrapping, it might be, look, I just need access to a particular technology or access to a particular center or facility. That's massively valuable to me. And on the other side, the other partner goes, sure. I mean, you know, zero marginal cost to offer you that space or that access. That makes a lot of sense. And then once you get one more benefit from each, it becomes interesting. And the reason it's interesting is that, you know, people don't... people just expect there'll be one benefit and we'll work out the other benefit down the road. When you've got two, it stands you above every other conversation that's going on, because it looks like you're invested in trying to make it work for the other party. Does that ring true for you in those partnerships?
Yeah, I would. I think what we learned, right, because we can offer like, here's what we do for programming. And it's like, cool, there's like a million events on campus. Mm-hmm. Like it's not really the big, like it's a, there's value, but it's not the value.
Yeah.
But what we've been able to, I think, learn, depending on who we're talking to, right? Like we have a mentor network of alumni that like can support these ventures, right? Mm-hmm. So we can, you know, if we need to grow that in particular ways, right, we can help them do that.
Yeah.
And then I think the one part which I didn't, it was not on my radar, was our systems. Like how you actually, like how do you organize applications? How do you organize your events? How do you communicate? Like that part, like I've rebuilt a lot of that in our center, and I didn't realize how much of a value that would be, that like if I can just like transfer, here's our Airtable templates to them.
Yeah.
Like that is such a huge trust builder, because it's like, oh my gosh, what do you mean I can save all this time? Mm-hmm. Right. Like,
yeah.
And just how we operate. Like if you can show people how to operate well, there's like way more value in that than I think we give ourselves credit for.
And this is such an important point, right? There will be value that is inherent in what you do, but until you step out of that bubble, there is no, it's, you know, it's like fish looking at water. You just don't know that it's there. And the ability for somebody to go, actually, this could be really valuable to us, should always be put on the table in those first kind of conversations. So let's go from the dual benefit. And just in case you're wondering, we're going, this word spells ideal, right? And we're talking about ideal partnerships for an organization. It's really important that we try and find these right things for people, because it's just how it works. We then think about the timeline, and I refer to that as the era, because I love the idea of somebody saying romantically, looking backwards, it's an end of an era, right? Quite a lot of affection when you think about it that way. So instead of saying what's the timeline or what's the duration, we think about a partnership being a three-year game at the minimum, right? And so we're trying to think about not an annual thing, certainly not a month by month. We're thinking about how do we create value over that time frame. And it just stretches people's perspective. Now, a lot of people are not great at looking into the future and trying to work out, well, if we're talking about this in September 2025, I have no idea what September 2028 is going to look like. And that's not the point. The point is that we're willing to see how this is going to go, because every partnership takes time to sort of sort itself out, no matter how good the intent is. So we go from there into what do we think about the people on the other side of the table? Do we have more than, you know, one person? And in large corporate organizations, the minimum for us is five people. There has to be five allies on the other side of the table in order for there to be redundancy. So if a deal falls over, if somebody moves role, if there's a reorganization, the whole partnership is not going to fall apart. And that happens so often that people think, no, it'll be fine. We all have LinkedIn. We all know how to use it. Go and start finding the people inside the organization, build the relationship if you need to, so that they can be your early warning on the inside of those other organizations. Super important step. Second last one has to do with landing the first win. So we can all wave our hands. We can all put logos on slide decks. But when somebody brings you into their organization, this is a little bit different outside the ecosystem for you, but when people think about a partnership and something, you being brought into a company, the thing is that the person that's bringing you in has put their political capital on the table in order for you to be welcomed into that organization. And you are a guest. And the way that you move from being a guest into part of the furniture is to repay that with a meaningful first win, so that their political capital can be regained and you can build trust, so you can sort of create more opportunities inside that organization. And so in a large corporate context, we think about that within 6 months. That has to land, so it's material. And a great example of that is in science, where if a scientific organization is coming into a large technology business and you have to do clinical studies, often the first thing that is really difficult to get across the line, which takes a lot of time, is getting an ethics approval or an approval to do studies to prove the technology works. And if you can land that material step within 6 months, then you're off to the races, right? Because it's such a big thing for both parties to have to work at. So whenever we think about, is a partnership going to work? Is it worth your time? Because we don't have a lot of it. We overlay that ideal framework across it. And if at the end of that, it says, you know, this looks pretty good, then you should pursue with a partnership. And if it's not, then you should really think about walking away from it.
Yeah, and actually funny you say that, because I'm like walking through all the steps in my head. We haven't had this framework, and everything you're talking about, I'm like, oh yeah, we actually did this. Here's how this works. Yeah. I can see like five people. I'm like, I even see that like how we bring software tools in. Like you're right. We need five people. So yeah, I love this.
Yeah, nice. Well, hopefully it's useful. I must have looked over 500 deals and been part of, you know, at least half of those. And it just dawned on me one day that there were these components that sort of all fit it in. I imagine it's quite similar to the Bootstrap report, right? When you sort of start seeing these patterns, you sort of go, this is how this works. I'm getting that now. It's a lot clearer now. So hopefully that was helpful.
Super helpful. I could, every time you would bring up a new letter, I was like, oh yeah, I see that too. This is great.
When you look at the founders that you work with and the ones you've seen, often there will be a breakthrough partnership that really helps them achieve something. And it's like, oh, we've now been able to distribute our product through a new channel, or we've been able to find a way to, you know, make the product cost of goods a lot less because we've got a new partnership with whatever the supplier partner is. Often making that a system, though, is pretty tricky. So in your experience, Matt, how are people moving from just closing off that one deal, that one kind of partnership, and sort of making it more of the way they do business? And that's a loaded question. I get it, because I'm hoping the answer is it happens all the time. But my instinct tells me, my experience tells me, it doesn't happen as often as I'd like it to happen. So what do you see happening in terms of the way that, you know, founders you work with or have seen are using partnerships to grow their business?
Yeah, and it is happening actually more and more. I think it's one of the more underrated strategies for growth. I think it's been cool because I think once you get that 250 mark, I actually think I have a feeling you do it more because it's more of like you have credibility, if you can bring more to the table. Like that's one of my like theories. I want to do a report on like the post 250.
Yeah.
And that's one of my theories of like you do it more. But I think right, like one of the companies I've done, I studied, was a company called Hugo and Hobie. And they do custom furniture, and they've actually built their entire business model from zero to millions of dollars in revenue now is based on partnerships. They just build partnerships, not like, right. It's very easy for them to be like, go to a build, like someone who's buying furniture and be like, hey, you should buy from us. Right. Like, but that's not actually how furniture gets sold. And the way they do it is actually partner with like the architects. They partner with the builders of the building. They partner with all these like adjacent partners.
Yeah.
And basically they never have to sell themselves because the architects, the builders, the whoever's like that is in that kind of ecosystem is selling for them essentially.
I love that.
And so they've grown to $3 million in revenue, or even post that, I think now, and it's fully bootstrapped. They have this, I mean, the furniture is gorgeous. I mean, it just like, but they don't sell. They just like build the furniture, and they don't even build the furniture. They like have craftsmen across the country to help build them. So it's this fully big old network of partnerships. I mean, the whole company is a big old partnership and across the board. There's probably hundreds of partnerships across that company if you really looked at it.
That is music to my ears. I mean, the leverage that's created by doing this kind of partnership-driven work is something that I think when people get it, it's like, oh, this is so much easier than, you know, by all means have a sales force. By all means have people that are, you know, doing this work to get your name out there. But when it comes to creating leverage, this is without doubt the best way of going about doing that.
Totally. I think it works, right? Like even there's even, I've done a lot of like service providers, right? Like, so if you're doing like consulting, those kind of things, there's been multiple founders who have told me about like they're doing services that have told me like they'll go to a conference and they'll have their booth, they'll do whatever. But like the people they care about are actually the people next to them. Cause right. If it's like a referral partner, like, and right. It just, I've heard that story without them even knowing each other. Talk about, it's the same story. I'm like, that's super fascinating. You're not even talking to your customers that are at the event. You're talking like potential customers at the event. You're talking to like the people next to you because your potential customers are getting pitched a million times at that event.
Mm-hmm. I just find it such a great mechanism to also enable people to then carry your message forward, right? If you are somebody who, you know, in that furniture example, is able to create a wickedly great product, it is so difficult to not have word of mouth take that to the next level. And I think the pro tip that we've learned in this is when people get to that place, but they don't see that step of growth as a consequence of a partner really singing from the rooftops about how good the product is, it's because that partner or the person who is at the center of that partnership has not created the ability for that to be sold well. So in the case of the furniture, the architects and the builders, what needs to happen there is a fantastically valuable and smooth referral system that makes them even more relevant as a consequence of, you know, selling that product. And that's where I think the next frontier of fantastic partnerships will be born out. It'll be where there is not some really crappy, you know, link that you share with someone for a referral program. It's sophisticated, it's personal. It creates a lot of material financial value for the people doing the referring, but it's done in a way which it's well controlled because you only want great people, you know, selling your stuff. So I think in the next 2 years, my prediction is going to be that the idea of referrals is going to take a vastly different shape and form.
Totally agree. Because I think especially even like as social media algorithms change, right? They're more interest-based, right? Mm-hmm. As we all keep hearing. The only way you're going to grow consistently is going to be collaborations, partnerships.
Yeah.
Like that's going to be what you can control. And if you're reliable, if you can, right, as you scope it out, and here's what we can do over 3 years together, like all these different things. If you can really just be a great operator and do the things you're really good at and then partner with the people who are not very good, like do the things, like partner with the people to do the things you're not very good at.
Yeah.
Like that to me is the superpower. And if you can figure all that out, it's a lot to figure out, but like, there's going to be some really cool businesses, Hugo and Hobie included, that like build some really, really cool businesses off of that.
You know, it's funny you mentioned Jay Klaus earlier, who I'm a big fan of, obviously Chanel and the team at Growth in Reverse. In our equivalent of Jay's lab, which is also called the Partnership Lab, we do exactly that. And we teach people how to understand, identify, and build a system around that. And when we first started that, I didn't really know what was going to become the most valuable thing. You know, we have a tagline, which is to help founders and go-to-market leaders close six-figure partnerships in 6 weeks and to do that on repeat. And that's a great promise. We deliver on that promise. But what I never realized was, and the consistent feedback I get is, but you gave me the confidence to be able to know who to reach out to, what to do, and to make that feel like a natural part of business. And we got more of this feedback yesterday. It was one of those points where you don't realize that at the basis of all of this is just confidence. And if you're able to give people just that sense inside themselves, they become a force multiplier like nothing else. You gave an example before. We have an example with an Australian healthcare software business who play a really important role. And this is, I don't know what the differences or the similarities are in the States. We have a thing called Medicare. I know you have a similar Medicare as well. And they are able to help clinics, doctors, clinics, dentists, work out if the patient is able to get an eligible payment as a consequence of getting a service with them. And it is essentially an API call that goes and pings to check and make sure if they're eligible before the transaction happens. It's happening in milliseconds, right? And that API connection has become an essential piece of healthcare infrastructure. And when we first met, we scholarshiped them into the Partnership Lab because that was quite new and still growing. And in 6 months of being in the lab, and I'm just so proud of the stat because we only learned it yesterday, their time to go from first conversation to issuing a contract has collapsed 80%, and their growth has gone in the other direction. It is skyrocketed because they now have the confidence to make this work. And so, you know, when we're thinking about the net positive value of having the tool set and the reflex and the system to build that out, it is a huge game changer for small and growing businesses.
Yeah, even at Yale, like go full circle, like there's some of our best successful ventures you look at, they were founders I talked to and had to convince to apply to things. And they just like had great ideas, they had the traction, they had everything buttoned up. They were just like, I don't have the confidence to do this.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely amazing. Yeah, just like giving someone like, hey, why are we not doing this? That little pep talk. And then all of a sudden you just see them take off.
Yeah, it is awesome.
There's so much of a mental game to all this stuff.
Yeah. Oh, so good. Matt, we're almost at the top of the hour, and I've loved this conversation. It's I feel like we're going to have many more conversations about this because it's been a lot of fun. Before we go, and I do have a rapid fire 5 questions I'd love to ask you, but before we do, I think we can both agree that partnerships for growth, both at a commercial level but also at a higher level, are really important. In 2025, what do you think leaders are missing about the power of partnerships?
I think they're missing you don't have to be like you don't need to be this super buttoned up thing to explore a partnership.
Yeah.
And you might not be, I think, right, it's like too much short-term thinking as well. So even if you get a no from someone that might be so much bigger than you, just like treat it as building a relationship. Like be on their LinkedIn, you know, be a human being.
Yeah.
Cause like, especially as a startup, right, you might be in a completely different place in 6 months where like, they're like, oh, actually, no, we actually see a ton of value. Or like, yeah, it's 2025, anything could happen. Like the world could be completely different in 6 months. So like, to me, I think that's the piece, especially from an early stage founder standpoint, is like, go for the people you think might be, you know, too far away from you. But like, and if they say no, just like treat it as building a relationship. And because you never know, time is going to be right somewhere, and like you might be evolving, they might evolve. Like you just never know like when the time is going to be right.
Yeah. I love that. And that curiosity is fantastic, right? I love building and nurturing relationships because you do never know where it's going to go. And I'm just genuinely interested in how people's lives play out. So I'm, you know, it's one of those things. Matt, let's jump into this rapid fire. You good to go?
Yeah, I'm good to go.
All right. So question one, complete this sentence. Partnership is?
A multiplier. I think your growth is so much better when you're partnering with people. I think one, you as a founder are better. And I think also two, just like you grow in ways, the business grows, you grow, and the partner grows, I think in ways you might never imagine.
Love that. What content are you loving at the moment?
There's a lot. So we've talked a lot about Chanel Basilio's Growth in Reverse. I'm also loving Pat Flynn's Pokemon content, which I know is probably a complete wild card.
No, it's good. It is really good.
It's really good.
Yeah.
And I think I'm not like, Pokemon cards are not my thing. Sports cards are more my thing. But like, I'm learning so much about the creator process, how he's thinking about being a creator just by watching his like content that's in a completely different space.
I am a student of Pat Flynn's, maybe three times over. And I just have so much time for how he thinks about this work. If what you're hearing right now is completely foreign to you, we're talking about Pat Flynn, who was the founder of Smart Passive Income and an online educator from the early 2000s. He does remarkable work. And he's also a giant Pokemon geek and has built YouTube channels and followings in the millions and millions and millions of people. I think hundreds of millions of views. It's really something else. He's a great guy. All right. Question three. What's the worst piece of advice you've received and why?
I think I gave this one away, but it was, you need to build a venture backable company to be a real founder. Yeah. That's like by far and away, like I believed in that lie and then came out of it, like shut down the company. I was like, no, I'm a real founder even without raising money.
Yeah.
That's by far the worst advice I've gotten.
Yeah. 100%. How about that? Cool. Question four. When you see potential for a new partnership, what's the first thing you do to turn that potential into action?
I just like build a relationship with the person. Like I won't go straight forward like, hey, we should partner when they don't know me.
Yep.
I'm more about like, I'll be in your LinkedIn. I will be in your comments in LinkedIn if you're posting. I'll go, if you're running events, I'll show up to them. Mm. I'll just be a human with them and be like, hey, can we just get coffee?
Yeah.
Or like, I'll just be a human with them and build that trust. And if there's the, like, if there's alignment, I feel like there's alignment. It's more like, hey, can we help with this? Mm-hmm. That's more of my approach, especially when it comes to like, you know, especially if it's a local partner, potential partner, I'm just be a human. That's my philosophy is just like treat people like people. And even if they're a big name and you think they're everything, like people like being treated like people.
Love it. Love it. And final question, what's one thing you're deeply grateful for right now?
Deeply grateful. I'm currently transitioning out of Yale. And I think one of the things I'm getting a lot of like really cool stories about my impact. They totally did it, but like just the cool stories I'm hearing behind the scenes, I kind of knew they existed, but like having them on paper and like at least digitally and on record has been one of the coolest things I've been experiencing in the last 2 weeks. There's probably more of it. I haven't left Yale fully yet. But I think it's been way more of a cool story that I'm going to be able to like cherish forever.
It's awesome. And I'm 200% confident that the impact you've had there has been quite enormous, and you know, it'll fold into what comes next, which I'm super excited to learn more about shortly. Matt, where can we send people to learn more about your work and the Bootstrap Report?
Yeah. So you can go to jointhequarter.com. Everything is there. And if you go to jointhequarter.com and then /bootstrapped, that is going to be the Bootstrap Report. It's a free download. There's no cost to it. You just like sign up for the newsletter. And then I post every other week a new deep dive on a bootstrap company went from zero to 250. Tell their ghost stories. Try to get as transparent as possible in those stories. So you can kind of actually see like, how did they actually do it? And one of the cool things that's happening currently is you can see there's actually conflicting advice now in these companies. I think that's one of my favorite parts.
Yeah, I love that. I really do enjoy it. So Matt, thank you so much for the time. It's been a real pleasure and I look forward to the next one.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Before you go, I have a quick question for you. Do you worry that you're wasting time, money, and credibility with the wrong partnerships? It's exhausting to pretend everything's fine while secretly worrying that you've made the wrong call. You see others thriving with the right connections, and you're stuck wondering if you're missing out on opportunities that could really elevate your business. Well, the good news is that ends today, because you can download my free partner calculator that instantly assesses if a partner is an ideal fit for your business. It'll give you the clarity and the confidence and the edge you've been looking for to secure high-value partnerships that not only finally unlock business growth, but also help you reclaim your time. The link is in the show notes. And I'm really glad you're here. I'm Coach Phil Hay-Sinclair. I'll see you in the next episode.